Welcome to Voices of the Community, which explores critical issues facing Northern California communities. We introduce you to the voices of community thought leaders and change makers who are working on solutions that face our fellow individual community members, neighborhoods, cities, and our region. This is George Koster, your host.
This episode is part of our series exploring COVID-19's impact on nonprofits and small businesses in the San Francisco Bay Area. Back in April of 2020, when we decided to create this ongoing series on COVID-19's impact, first on nonprofits and then on small businesses in the San Francisco Bay Area, we, like you, had no idea how long the pandemic would go on and what the health and economic impact would be in our community. Going into 2021, the pandemic is now killing more people, shutting down more nonprofits and small businesses, along with wiping out the livelihoods of families, neighborhoods, and communities. We will continue to shine a spotlight on the nonprofits and small businesses that make up the fabric of our community, along with the founders and staff who are struggling to deal with the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic on their operations, services, and sustainability until we can all get to the other side of the pandemic. Along the way, we will also share with you all the amazing solutions that our nonprofits, small businesses, foundations, and government leaders are working on to help us all get to the other side of the pandemic and come together to rebuild our communities with more economic, social, and environmental equality.
Probably one of the largest impacts, again, is just the security of having somewhere to live. Knowing that people were let off work, a lot of my young people were laid off work or let off. For your average citizen, if we're let off, you know, they say that maybe we have 3 months of savings saved up to be able to pay our bills and still live. And as we all know, if you don't have a roof over your head, it's hard. It's unbearable. You know, where am I going to eat? How am I going to sleep? How am I going to stay safe? Where are my belongings going to go?
The focus of this week's show is on how the COVID-19 pandemic is impacting our youth and the nonprofit organizations that provide support services to help youth through this crisis. Our first voice is the Transitional Housing Program Supervisor of Uplift Family Services, Faith Jackson.
I'm joined remotely via Zoom by Faith Jackson, the Transitional Housing Program Supervisor of Uplift Family Services. Thanks for being here, Faith.
Thank you for having me.
So could you please provide the audience just a quick overview of who Uplift Family Service Programs are? Because it's a regional organization with an amazing kind of ecosystem, if you will, of wraparound services for families.
Yes, definitely. So the agency overall, it's one of the largest, most comprehensive behavioral treatment space in California, one of the bigger providers. Each year we serve and do whatever it takes to help about 35,000 children and families to manage and recover from challenges stemming from trauma, such as severe neglect and abuse, and learn essential life skills that they need to be successful at home or school and in their communities. And so our short mission statement is, we do whatever it takes to strengthen and advocate for children, family, and adults and communities to realize their hopes and behavior, health, and well-being.
You supervise the TAE program. So if you could explain what TAE, as we were saying before we came on, acronyms are us, what TAE is and then what the TAE program is, and you know, who are the residents that you serve?
Great. So that stands for Transitional Age Youth. My specific program that I supervise is the Transitional Housing Program. Our young people are foster children, and their ages range anywhere between 16 to 21. And before 2012, young people at the age of 18 were just put out of foster care and hadn't learned some of the most important life skills. And so in 2012, there was a bill called Assembly Bill 12, and that extended foster care voluntarily for young people from 18 to 21 to give them extra time just to learn life skills and live on their own and just accomplish life goals, you know?
These are youth that really have kind of aged out of foster service. Is that right?
Well, what happens is now after Assembly Bill 12, young people can voluntarily stay. And so on their 18th birthday, they are offered to stay in care until the age of 21, the day before their 21st birthday. And if they agree, then they can use these additional services. And so this particular program I supervise, we actually deal mainly with young people 18 to 21, showing them how to live in their own apartments and supervise them living there.
Fifth, can you describe a little bit more of the services that you provide? It's really more than just, hi, here's a place to live. You're providing a whole series of wraparound services.
Definitely. So through the transitional housing program, aside from just the housing, it's day-to-day living, again, because we're helping young people build that bridge to the next step, right? Being sure that it takes, how do you pay a bill? How do you clean a house? How do you get along with a roommate, right? If you're going to live in the Bay Area and the price of rent, you're probably going to have a roommate. So that's a life skill. How do I do that? At the same time, gaining employment and the education to have an employment that can afford you to live out on your own or with a roommate. Also, building permanent connections. What does that look like when, in fact, your nuclear family could have been busted up for whatever reason? How do I now go out and build my own family? What does that look like? My support, my identity sometimes for young people, helping them to identify who that is, and also dealing with whatever past traumas and any other things that have happened, and how do I still navigate through life with those issues? And now how do I work this out on my own as an adult, but with support? Because the reality of it is who of us was ready at 18 or 21 for that matter to live your whole life independently without any support or any help from any other adult figure? Very few of us.
So we're going into our 14th month now of the pandemic. And so much about the pandemic is literally, you know, the whole idea of having a place to sequester, right? To be safe, to, you know, hang out with friends, family, et cetera. So how has COVID-19 impacted the TAE program and your services and the ability to provide services for your youth?
So a couple things happened. Initially, when it first started, the world was on lockdown. And then it became, again, we are essential workers. We can't afford to be locked in because we still have youth looking for services, youth looking for needs. And at the same time, how does my staff provide that and still stay healthy and safe for their own selves and their own families? And so those are some of the things that we had to work around. One of the things that happened is that young people had to age out at 21. Well, Governor Newsom saw that, hey, this is a pandemic. Where are these young people going to go? And so there was an extension sign, which was great for our young people, because again, even for myself, if I was having a problem with an apartment or needed to get another apartment, I couldn't get a call back because everyone was home. It was a pandemic. And so our young people would face some of the same issues. And so we were able to go out and provide housing, and still not only housing, but just human contact during this time, helping guide young people. Who tells the young person who's sheltered in place how to get a meal, where to get a meal, how to get around, or just someone to say hello to? So we were able to provide that during this time as well.
So if someone is listening to our show today, how can they support Uplift's TAE program and the youth and families that you serve? Is there an opportunity, obviously, to make a donation or to volunteer or to mentor?
There definitely is opportunities, several ways. We have donations. I like for my young people to, we give them incentives sometimes, you know, we give them a certain amount of money to live off every month. But of course, it's not a king's ransom. It's just enough to kind of get you by because they're either going to be working or in school. So a lot of times people want to know, well, what are they doing with, you know, that free housing? What are they doing? Well, during that time, we're hoping that they're either going to school. If a young person does our program correctly, well, you'll definitely have an AA if you decide to do it. And you can almost be done with the BA. I've had a couple of young people who doubled up on classes and they left with the BA. And so therefore they were prepared to live out on their own. But what's helpful for them is the little things. And so we like to give them incentives around small gift cards for certain stores. People don't think about what does it cost to buy toilet paper and cleaning products and things like that when you don't have a lot of money. Even sometimes just to buy the special things. Sometimes you just want a little gift from a Ross or a Marshalls. And so gift cards in small increments, and for us, a small increment is anywhere between 25 you know, $50. That is always helpful for us when we provide the young people an apartment. So just to give a little more background, we provide an apartment, we pay all of the rent, and we fully furnish the apartment. And we furnish it everything from the toilet paper to the bedding to every piece of furniture in the house. And so any donations along those lines are also helpful. Also, personally, I collect suitcases. I've been in the business now 30 years. And so that was one of my things that I always hated to see a young person spend, you know, 18 years in foster care and now sometimes 21 and leave with all your prized possessions in a trash bag, right? What does that say? And so I started a suitcase drive. And so you can pack your things and carry them away in a suitcase, or you can go on a trip and have a suitcase and not a plastic bag or a backpack. Little things like that. Those things matter.
So Faith, would you please share with the audience one of your favorite moments of working at Uplift's TAE program?
So I personally have been with this program now. I think this is my 11th year now that I've been with this particular program. And I have been able to see young people come in, not quite ready. There's one specific young lady. She came in and she did not have a personal family connection. She had a child, and probably 2 months ago, she sent me an invitation to her graduations for her master's degree, along with a beautiful photo of her daughter and how she's grown. And those are the little things. Don't get me wrong, they're huge, but it's the little things, or it's just that client that may not have been the perfect client, but because my number has never changed, they always call me and say, now I get it. Even if they didn't get it then, now I get it. So that is amazing to me.
That's a great story. And Faith, so final question, what would you see as some of the positive things that could come out of this crisis to support our youth and families?
A few of the positive things that I see, one being the most important, is that, you know, everyone understood that we needed more time. We needed to provide housing and not dismiss young people and not be ready. I think that it also helped the young people understand that weren't quite ready, like, this isn't going to be forever, and I need to take this opportunity and make the best of it right now, because it's going to be an end date, right? We got an extension, but there's going to be an end date. But it also, it helped them to understand that they weren't really alone. A lot of times in these services and in these programs, you know, they get a feeling that the person that's helping them is only helping them for a paycheck. But knowing that they had someone to check in on them, knowing that they had someone to come by and see them, even if it was with PPE, but knowing that someone was still looking out for them when in fact they didn't have to, but they felt like they definitely needed to.
I really hope it's an opportunity for people to see all of the needs that have been there all along and step up and help provide that helping hand.
Yes, I agree.
Thank you, Faith, for sharing Uplift's TAE program's work today. We'll make sure that listeners have your contact information, website, and social media so they can follow Uplift Family Service programs and get engaged in the work and to help your mission. Please stay safe and healthy as we all work our way through this very strange new normal.
Thank you.
You're listening to Voices of the Community, which explores critical issues facing Northern California communities. This is George Koster, your host, and if you're just joining us, in this episode, we're discussing the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic on nonprofits, small businesses, and our local governments in the San Francisco Bay Area. You've been listening to the voice of the Transitional Housing Program Supervisor of Uplift Family Services, Faith Jackson. To find out more about Uplift Family Services and to support foster youth with gift cards and donating suitcases, as well as other programs, go to liftfs.org.
So I think one of the biggest impacts to the youth and the families is just being able to learn that. Like, that's such a big part. And just knowing the history of your city is very, very important. And if you want to make change, you got to know what has happened before. And, you know, that also allows for history to not repeat itself. And I think it builds for more resilient youth.
This is the Community Program Coordinator, Alex Velasco, of Literacy for Environmental Justice. We wanted to feature the work of Literacy for Environmental Justice because of their unique and integrated effort of supporting youth in our community through utilizing environmental education, leadership and skills training, and the incubation and placement of native plants into our urban environment.
I'm joined remotely via Zoom by Leandria Morton, Senior Development Consultant, Community Program Coordinator Alex Velasco, and Executive Director Patrick Marley Rump from Literacy for Environmental Justice. Thanks for being here, Leandria, Alex, and Patrick.
Well, thank you very, very much.
And then Patrick, I'm going to turn to you and ask you to please provide the audience a kind of a quick overview of who is Literacy for Environmental Justice.
Literacy for Environmental Justice, or LEDGE, is a community-based grassroots nonprofit. We're in Bayview Hunters Point, or District 10 of Southeast San Francisco. We're basically like a combination of young adults, youth, educators, activists, environmentalists, you know, have come together to kind of create environmental justice and social change in Bayview Hunters Point, illuminating all the stuff, the not in my backyard stuff that exists in Bayview. There's 325 toxic sites in Bayview Hunters Point. And really, I think there was a strong movement to address the environmental injustices and impacts on the Bayview Hunters Point community, but there really wasn't a mechanism to engage youth. So our founding director paired up with some youth in high school and came up with the idea of creating a organization or a project that could bridge the gap between the advocacy of the elders and the next generation.
And then, Patrick, you have three kind of major, what I would consider to be tentpole programs. So you have eco adventures, you have eco apprenticeships, and then you have your plant nursery, which you talked about. Could you provide a little bit more information on the adventures and the apprenticeships program?
Yeah, so eco adventures is really this idea of like making it fun and culturally relevant to get people outdoors. We're trying to put the Bay back in Bayview and also trying to connect people to this idea that nature isn't something you have to travel to. Nature is something that's in your community. So that's the Eco Adventure program. The Eco Apprentice program is our young adult program, which has been an outgrowth of years of youth development program and youth programming. This program looks to provide green collar job training for 18 to 25 year old local youth so that they can become a part of the environmental movement. So it's really working to address some of the diversity, equity, inclusion, and representation gaps in the environmental field, as well as to kind of create like intensive year-long paid internships for the next generation to kind of like become the green-collared stewards that our planet needs. And we also do Eco Stewards, which is another program, which is inviting the public at large and other groups like ourselves to create the change in the community by working in our native plant nursery, outplanting the ecological restoration sites that we have. We have several ecological restoration sites in Bayview alone. And I think the glue that connect them all is the native plant nursery. The eco adventure and the native plant nursery is kind of like a hub for all of our activity. Currently, we actually have two nurseries. We have one on Treasure Island for a project on Yerba Buena Island. And we have the Candlestick, a native plant nursery, which we've been operating in Bayview since 2005. Combined, both of those nurseries allow us to grow like 50, 60,000 native plants annually and provide, you know, jobs to local youth and mechanisms for community engagement.
Staying with you, Patrick, so much of what you do is in person. So how has COVID impacted Literacy for Environmental Justice over this last 14 months? And what have you and the team done to, I hate to use the term, but of course it's everyone's favorite term, pivot, to adjust to a world where you can't be up close and personal?
Well, I think that's been a really big challenge for us. I think there's nothing virtual about nature. And I think one of the things that we were really fortunate, some programs had to be put on hold. So volunteerism had to be put on hold. And I think Alex will speak about this later as our Eco Adventure program. But because we're tied to public infrastructure, meaning native plants and green infrastructure, and because our work is outdoors and because agriculture was deemed an essential business, luckily we were able to keep an entire cohort of young adults and program staff running our nurseries throughout the entire length of the pandemic. And we're able to keep people employed. We were able to move people from certain departments and put them in the greening department just so that there would be meaningful work for them during the pandemic. And I think that's largely how we kind of pivoted.
Thank you. So coming to you, Alex, since you know you are the community program coordinator out in the community, what do you feel has been the largest impact of the programs on not only the Bayview community, but I would say the community at large here in San Francisco?
Yeah, I think our programs has opened a lot of youth to what is actually going on in the Bayview. Like Patrick has said, we work with SWSD, so that allows us to bring not only students from the Bayview, but other neighborhoods into our park And at that park, you know, we talk about all the pollutants and all the issues that surround the Bayview and, you know, all the history, you know, such as the shipyard and just all the changes in land that has happened in the Southeast. So I think one of the biggest impacts to the youth and the families is just being able to learn that. Like that's such a big part. And just knowing the history of your city is important. And if you want to make change, you got to know what has happened before. And, you know, that also allows for history to not repeat itself. And I think it builds for more resilient youth.
Thank you. And turning to you, Leandra. So for all of our listeners out there, how can they support Literacy for Environmental Justice programs and the youth and families that you guys serve? Besides, can they volunteer at some point, donations, etc.?
We are hoping that there will be more volunteer opportunities to come in the future. Right now, one of the biggest ways that folks can support us is by supporting our native plant nursery and community garden expansion project. So this is a big project that we have going on right now. It is a major capital construction project that broke ground in March 2021. So the expansion project is going to include expanding the footprint of the native plant nursery with a shade house and a greenhouse that is going to double our native plant production in the first year. We're also going to remove 9,500 square feet of degraded asphalt. We'll have a bioswale to capture 75,000 gallons of rainwater annually. We'll also have a large-scale rainwater collection system that will serve an irrigation system and is calculated to provide an net 109,000 gallons in a normal year. And together with the native plant landscaping that we're going to do, this is estimated to reduce our water use by one third. We will also have native plants representing every San Francisco ecosystem. And there will be a community gathering structure where people can cook and host community events. So for this project, we've already raised $1.2 million, and we only need to raise $150,000 more to finish construction by this fall 2021. So you and anyone you know can support the Native Plant Nursery and Community Garden expansion by visiting ledgeyouth.org. That's L-E-J-Youth, Y-O-U-T-H.org. And you can click donate. That's in the upper right corner. And we have a lot of wonderful community partners that support us in this work. And two of them I want to shout out to that you can follow on Instagram are the Park Prescription Program. You can follow them at park.rx and Green Action. That's Green Action underscore EJ. You can also follow Ledge on Instagram at LEJ Youth and on Facebook.
So this is our final question. And this for each of you, I'm going to start with Leandra first. So what would you say are some of the positive things that could come out of this crisis to support our youth and families?
I think the first thing that came to mind was what we discussed earlier, which was that as an organization, we had to restructure and really emphasize our young adult workforce development crew. And, you know, before COVID had initiated last year, our ICO apprentices would sometimes enter at different times and then exit at different times. And it's really solidified a cohort model. So it's just that being able to build up a team and relationship with each other. I think it helps young people feel like they have people to lean on. And so I think it really helped build just a sense of like camaraderie and teamwork among our staff and team, honestly. And I think that that's something that we can carry forward.
Thank you. And Alex, coming to you.
I think some of the good things that are already come out of this is, like Leandra said, we were able to restructure and now put our mind and our work like fully into supporting the community. But I think another thing that's also another positive is that we're focusing a bit more on, you know, our mental health. Before, we talk about mainly plants, but now I think we're realizing as an organization and as many other organizations that mental health plays into this. And, you know, we are doing a bit more programming with mental health. So that, I think that's one good positive. We're more aware of mental health and trying to figure out how we can incorporate plants and talking about environmental justice with mental health and doing other things besides just the plans to deal with it, such as yoga in the park or painting in the park with some community leaders.
Thank you. And Patrick?
I would say I really hope we don't go back to business as usual. I'm already getting a feeling that the world is like eager to reopen and it might head that way. But if there's one thing that I feel like our world and our organization needs to really hold on to is like listening to people, listening to communities, listening to experts. A lot of these problems that were magnified during the pandemic were already here. And I think we're at a place where if we really don't take heed of what's in front of us and take action, we're going to live in a pretty miserable world. But I think we might still have time to make some change. I'm hoping that particularly, you know, our organization works a lot with youth and works a lot with schools. So I'm hoping that there's a reformation with our local school district and that schools really see the value in getting kids outdoors and having tangible ways for them to take care of themselves and reconnect with each other and reconnect with nature after we've been indoors for like the last year. So I feel like these are all things that are in front of us and, you know, the future isn't written. So hopefully we can make that change.
Thank you, Leandria, Alex, and Patrick for sharing Literacy for Environmental Justice Program's work today. We'll make sure that listeners have your contact information, website, and social media so they can follow Literacy for Environmental Justice Programs, get engaged in the work to help your mission, hopefully raise that $100,000+, Leandria, for that wonderful nursery expansion. And please stay safe and healthy as we work our way through this very strange new normal.
That's it for this episode of Voices of the Community. You've been listening to the voices of the Senior Development Consultant, Leandra Morton, Community Program Coordinator, Alex Velasco, and Executive Director Patrick Marley Rump from Literacy for Environmental Justice. To find out more about Literacy for Environmental Justice's Eco Adventures, Eco Apprenticeships, and to donate to the Native Plant Nursery and Community Garden Expansion Project that Leandra spoke of, please go to lejyouth.org. We also heard from Faith Jackson of Uplift Family Services. For more insights into how our youth are being impacted by the pandemic and how our nonprofits are supporting our youth through the pandemic, please listen to our interview with the Executive Director of the Huckleberry Youth Programs, Doug Stiles, in Episode 19, Charles Lerner, the Executive Director, and Marie Miller, the Program Manager of At the Crossroads, in Episode 29, along with the Chief Program Officer, Justine Underhill, and the Director of Advancement, Greg Biggs, from Edgewood Center for Children and Families, in Episode 54. Tune in to next week's two shows, where our theme is the importance of our small businesses on our community and how they've been dealing with the pandemic. For our Thursday, June 3rd show, we will be rebroadcasting on KSFP our interview with Julie Cowles, the District Director of the Small Business Administration's San Francisco District Office, and Al Spector, an advisor to nonprofit and mission-driven organizations. And on Friday, June 4th, we have another one-hour special featuring a panel discussion with Mario Maganum, the president of the San Francisco Council of District Merchants Associations, small business owner Tracy Sylvester of EHS Pilates, Adam Fowler, the director of research at Beacon Economics, and Amanda Fried, the chief of policy and communications at the San Francisco Treasurer and Tax Collector's Office. This one-hour special will be broadcast on KSFP 102.5 FM on Friday, June 4th at 7 a.m. and 2 p.m., Saturday, June 5th at 5 p.m., and again Sunday, June 6th at 9 a.m. We hope that you enjoyed the insights, points of view, and personal stories from the voices of changemakers and their nonprofits and small businesses featured in this series. To find out more and get engaged with the nonprofits, small businesses, and staff members featured in this series, please go to my website, georgecoster.com, and click on Voices of the Community to find links to the extended versions of these interviews and to listen to the entire series. After listening to these stories, we hope that you will consider making a donation and volunteering to provide a hand up to your fellow community members. I want to thank my associate producer, Eric Estrada, and Casey Nance at Citron Studios, along with the wonderful crew at the San Francisco Public Press and KSFP. Voices of the Community is a member of Intersections for the Arts, a tax-deductible nonprofit organization. More information can be found at georgecoster.com, where donations are also accepted to provide programs like this one. While you're on our website, you can enjoy our archived past shows, which feature community voices working on solutions to critical issues facing Northern California communities, And you can sign up for our newsletter to find out more about future shows, as well as shows and events from the organizations that are included in our episodes. Take us along on your next COVID walk by subscribing to Voices of the Community on Apple Podcast, Spotify, and Google Podcast, or wherever you get your podcast. You can follow us on Twitter at George Koster, and we'd love to hear from you with feedback and show ideas, so send us an email to george@georgekoster.com. I'm George Koster in San Francisco, and thank you for listening.
Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at KBOO.FM.
At KBOO, we accept many kinds of vehicle donations. We accept fuzzy vans, broken cars, zippy scooters, seaworthy boats, well-worn farm equipment, family-sized SUVs, old jet skis, and more. If your vehicle has a clean title, we can take it as a donation. If your vehicle isn't working, we can work with that too. Call 877-KBOO-123. That's 877-526-6123. Or go to our website, kboo.fm/vehicle.
From Pacifica Radio in San Francisco, this is Flashpoints. I'm Dennis Bernstein.